Good evening, folks. This is The Weird Part, and I am your host, Vincent Treewell. Tonight I have a very special guest returning to the show, occultist Octavian Graves, host of the Strange Dominions podcast. Welcome, Octavian.
Hey, how you doing? Glad to be back.
Oh, glad to have you. We had a really fascinating discussion last time, and certainly I expect that it'll be the same or better this time.
Absolutely. I had a lot of fun.
Cool. Glad to hear it, because it was certainly my pleasure. Just to dive right in, you are a ceremonial magician and a practicing witch, correct?
Yes.
Could you explain the differences and commonalities between ceremonial magic and witchcraft?
Yeah, so it's kind of one of those things that there really is no difference. The only difference comes from more of like a societal aspect rather than practice. The one thing I will say is that the ceremonial magician is a lot more orderly in how they do things. They go by what is written down in the books of the systems they're working in, at least starting out. There is a specific order that everything needs to be done in. Timing matters. It's just everything is by the book, whereas witchcraft is much more open, natural, free, I guess you could call it, usually rural. And at the end of the day, it's magic, right? Like, what they're doing might look different from each other, but it's not.
And maybe witchcraft could be said to be more folk magic.
Yeah, there are definitely ritual elements to traditional witchcraft. But for the most part, it is more folky, and they're both spirit based. And actually, one of the interesting things about the two is that, and this is something that a lot of people don't know, spirits teach magic. That is like one of their primary roles and has been since time immemorial. In ceremonial magic, grimoire magic, ritual magic, however you want to call it, when you successfully summon a spirit, you are supposed to obviously bind it so it would tell you the truth and not hurt you in any way. But you ask it how you can get in contact with it easily, or if there's a specific task that you want done that it's very good at, you could ask it to do that task, or you could say, "Spirit, please, I command you to give me basically a shortcut to that task, or a shortcut to you to do that task." So instead of me not having sex for 9 days and fasting and praying for 9 days, can you give me something that I can call you real quick, get you to this thing, and da 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 da.
And I'm sorry to interrupt. I'm only chuckling because early on in talking with you, about ceremonial magic, I realized I lacked the self-control to summon spirits. So I kind of just. Yeah,
it's definitely a challenge. And a lot of people, I think everyone is physically capable of doing it, but I don't think everyone is really able to do it. Does that make sense?
Oh, yes. It makes total sense. The barriers are high.
Yes, for sure. But basically, once you do that, the way a spirit will instruct you will look a lot almost identical to what we would call like spellcraft. It'll say like, okay, well, if you want to call me real quick to do this specific task, take a string, tie it around some weeds, say this thing over it, and then throw it behind your shoulder, and that task will be done by me. And so one of the theories a lot of people have is that that happens so much, but we forgot the names of the spirits that were actually doing the task. And then we forgot that the spirit was involved at all.
Okay. So you're kind of confusing the effect with the being providing the effect.
Right. And so basically what I've always taken that to mean is that a successful ceremonial magician will not be that unlike a witch.
Okay.
They kind of dovetail into each other.
Okay. I think that makes a lot of sense.
Yeah.
When a lot of people think of magic or witchcraft, they think of Satanism, both in pop culture and historically. Do you have any experience? What would you say to that?
You got to read the sources and really figure out for yourself how involved Satan is in any of it. Really. That would be my thing to say to anyone asking about it, because he makes an appearance. He's not, and when I say he, in the Grimoire tradition, and I feel like we went over this last time, but I'll just, reiterate it. In the Grimoire tradition, and the actual entities change, but most grimoires prescribe hell to a triumvirate, meaning that there are three spirits that are in charge of it. And the standard is Satan, Lucifer, and Beelzebub. Sometimes Astaroth takes the place of Beelzebub, but most of the time it's Beelzebub, Satan, and Lucifer. And a lot of people are probably listening to this and like, well, isn't Lucifer and Satan the same thing? And I'm not sure about how it is in the Bible because I've never read the Bible, but in the Grimoire tradition, no, they're two different things. And in fact, a lot of Grimoires will say that Satan himself is inaccessible. So like you can, in the Grimoire Inverum, you can summon Lucifer to physical appearance. In other Grimoires, you can contact him in other ways. Satan is too far down for us to contact him, and he is too far down for him to contact us.
And you wouldn't want to really do that, probably, because there would be side effects that you would not want.
Yeah, I mean, that goes for any of the spirits, really. But Lucifer, being as powerful as he is, he's also the most untrustworthy and difficult to manage. Same with Beelzebub. Once you start getting into the higher ranking spirits, the danger becomes much more apparent.
I would assume that most ceremonial magicians don't want to deal with the 4-star generals. They want to deal with the sergeant who takes charge of, this specific thing.
Right.
Yes. Okay. That makes a lot of sense. That's a kind of a concise explanation.
There are some prescriptions, basically to pray is a very general term here. You basically make a prayer to the three chiefs of hell, and you basically say, listen, I'm not trying to overthrow you. I'm not trying to, do anything to you. I would just very much like your help in wrangling these lesser spirits to get things done for me. So maybe we can kind of work together here. So you are kind of there are certain points to making a truce with these kind of spirits. And before anyone gets this twisted, souls are not a form of payment. There is no interest in souls by these spirits whatsoever. They have no interest in being around us, period. The last thing they want to do is be anywhere around what we are metaphysically.
Okay, that's fascinating. So the whole concept of the deal with the devil, and then he gets your soul, that's really just
that is church propaganda.
Exactly. And pop culture things that are, it's a trope, but it doesn't really happen like that.
Well, yeah, absolutely.
Okay. And I realize some of this, it sounds kind of, entry level, but not everyone knows that.
Yeah,
and
of course.
Coming to this, it's like, unless your background is a lot different than my own, it does seem like something that you kind of have to ask about, because it's not self-explanatory. Mm-hmm. And this is, all of this is esoteric. It's for the few to know and not for the masses. Sound about right?
Yeah, and it gets even a little bit more confusing when you get into traditional witchcraft. And when I say traditional witchcraft, I am saying that to kind of differentiate it from what I would call modern witchcraft, which is like Wicca.
Yes.
Traditional witchcraft is more rooted in like trial records and accounts from that time. Huh? And a lot of practitioners of that form talk about something called the witch's devil. And what that basically is, it's kind of like saying this isn't actually the devil, but the Christians have been calling these entities devils for so long, we're just going to tweak the meaning and keep it instead of trying to throw it away all the time. So usually when you hear someone talking about the witch's devil, they're usually referring to a pagan deity that has been demonized by the church.
Okay. And now this is I'm speculating here, but this is a thought that I've had for quite a few years. That do you think it's possible that during the era of the witch trials, the Christian church, which is mostly the Roman Catholic Church, but also the Church of England after Henry VIII, was so oppressive and so brutal and so, for lack of a better word, patriarchal,
yeah,
that maybe there were groups, mostly of women, who snuck away on the full moon to have orgies and drink and do drugs and just get away from all that and worship Satan because the witch's devil would probably be a much better explanation, but worship the devil just because they were getting such a bad deal from the church.
Yeah, I'm sure. I would put money on that happening.
That made a lot of sense to me too, that people who were really oppressed and, you know, just a punitive system where the church was extremely powerful and abused that power heavily, that there would be some people who would just like, well, this is the deal I'm getting from the Christian God. I'm going to do the opposite and go at midnight and worship the devil, but not necessarily have any, and not necessarily have any real, like, summoning of spirits, mostly just a kind of get together to get away from.
It was a party in the devil's name, basically.
Precisely, yes. And that's always wrong. That might be true, you know?
Yeah, I would definitely agree with that.
Okay. Well, great. Just as a kind of an easy segue, what are your thoughts on Anton LaVey, the Church of Satan, and the Satanic Bible?
I don't know much. I know about as much as like most people do. I never got into it. I never found much validity or purpose in it or utility in it. Mainly because it's more on a psychological model. It's more about the devil being a representation of freedom and things like that, rather than any kind of belief in objective spirits.
Yes, I believe LaVey was.
I mean, really,
a complete edgy
Satanism,
atheist.
Or edgy, yeah. Edgy atheism. Yes,
and I have never, like, I have never read the Satanic Bible, but I do get his philosophy because when I was younger, I was really into Ayn Rand, and there isn't that much difference. He said it himself repeatedly that I give people Ayn Rand's philosophy with some ritual attached. But she didn't believe in spirits or really anything. She was like a materialist, you know, atheist.
Oh, 100%.
And he, I think, was too, you know. And he added some things that were kind of, there are rituals. I'm not really familiar with his work beyond that. But he was not into talking about Satan as, or any of this as, really being actual entities you can communicate with.
Yeah. I mean, and that also, you know, that it's very much a product of its time.
Yes.
And he was taking a lot from Crowley, who was pretty much, you know, he didn't start the psychological model when it comes to magic, but he is the number one proponent of it, and he's the one who spread it the most. I mean, the second he put in that the goetic spirits were portions of the mind, it all just kind of broke down from there, you know. And I think a lot of magicians and occultists who are on the spirit model feel a certain way about that, because that was the lay of the land for like 100, like, you know, 80 to 100 years, that was the predominant model, whereas before that it was the spirit model since time immemorial. We are now getting back to a more predominant spirit model, but the psychological model was just very, you know, I shouldn't say rampant, because, you know, there are people who believe in it, and that's totally fine. I have no problem with you, with anyone believing in it. But it was very much like, this is the new way, spirits are out, you know?
Oh, yes. The, essentially, you're just talking to yourself, and you're creating, if there are effects in the outside world, it's because you basically created them psychically.
Right, or, exactly.
Yes. But there are no actual entities you're summoning. You're doing these things, but it's really all just you in your own head. And that's really different than actual magic.
Yeah, I mean, really, you get more into existential philosophy than you do anything magical when you start getting into those headspaces, because then you're like, okay, well, if spirits aren't real and we make our own reality, are we real? What is real? What is real? You know, like, you spend so much time doing that when you could have been, you know, making yourself money or getting a girlfriend or you know, seeing weird stuff.
Yes, and I appreciate your, you know, directness with, hey, if I'm going to do all this stuff, I don't just want to have psychological breakthroughs that I could probably get through a licensed therapist. I want to have stuff happen in the real world that I make happen.
Right.
That makes a lot of sense to me, you know? I think those were some really succinct and great answers to some rather complicated questions.
I appreciate that. Thank you.
Absolutely. To shift gears a little bit, and I'm just, be as broad or as narrow as you care to, what are your own beliefs about what happens to us after death?
Boy, that's a difficult one, because there, you know, I have, in the course of basically 3 years, read through and investigated so many different cultures and traditions and models on that very question, and it's almost like not even enough to say I don't know. The things that I feel more certain about than not are that something does happen. It is not just pitch black for eternity. There, you know, and then you have to, what I have to do is I have to figure out, okay, what do I actually believe and what am I hoping for? Like, what's my bias here? And like, my hope is that there's a way to retain memory and consciousness after death, you know?
Yes. Oh, I hear you. My own perspective, I am an agnostic. I do not pretend to know. And I think anybody who says they know, I find that very questionable, at best. I can accept the atheist materialist idea that you die and it's just game over and you were nothing but physical atoms and they're gone now. It sucks, but I can accept that that is a possibility. I don't like that possibility, but I set that on one side. That could be the answer. I can accept that we go on to some other realm. And what that might be, there are many possibilities. I personally believe in reincarnation. And that's based on some intense experiences that I've had. Not a lot, but some, and they really hit home. And that is what I believe. But I can't prove it to anybody. And, you know, marshaling all the evidence, I don't have enough to really prove that. But yeah, I believe... Go ahead.
I believe in reincarnation, or the possibility of reincarnation, 100%. I don't know that much about it. I haven't done that much digging into it. It's a really, really fascinating phenomena. And I know the studies that have been done, and I know the accounts of the children who can tell you where they were buried and things like that. And I find it very...
I love that stuff. Yes.
I do too. You know, the study that they're doing down in Virginia is really, really incredible, honestly.
There is, and I forget the name of it, there is one university. Is it the University of Virginia? I'm not sure.
I think so. I was like, I'm pretty sure, but I could be wrong.
That has a department devoted to that. And that's pretty, that's extremely unique. I notice Carl Sagan, who, you know, notoriously didn't believe in any of this, did hold out as one of the possible, they ask him, what are some paranormal things that might be true? And his top three was reincarnation, because of Indian children who could tell you all about their past life. And then they came back, and they only came back to a different village like 10 miles away. And mm-hmm. it was coherent, and it seemed credible to him. And it seems very credible to me. A lot of experiences that people have had, and that people with small children knowing things and talking about things that happened in their past lives, really strike home. And that's what I go with. That's my current working hypothesis, is that it's probably reincarnation.
Yeah.
But once you say that, well, what do you mean by reincarnation? Because mm-hmm. there's the Buddhist kind where you are a drop of water and you go back into the ocean and you don't retain your personality and your memories. And I'll be blunt. I don't like that kind.
I hate that too. Because
exactly.
Like,
I don't want to do that.
And this might sound very, I hope this doesn't sound like egotistical or narcissistic in any way, but like, I like me, you know, like I'm very comfortable in who I am. I enjoy who I am. You know, I don't find like, the whole like, oh, we need to separate ourselves from the ego. Like, I get it. I understand the utility in that, but it's not something I'm super fond of. Like,
exactly. I don't want to immerse my ego and be one with, I want to be me. Okay. Right. Like me, you know, I get exactly that.
Like, and I would be totally okay with experiencing like living in a new body, in a new country and things like that. And like,
oh, yes.
Life, as long as I'm still me.
Yeah, exactly. You know? And there's a connection. It's the same personality inhabiting different bodies. That's what I want.
The one thing I've always wondered is, like, you know, when people go and get like past life regression therapy, is there been any kind of cases where they start to like embody the personality of who they were before, and it's just natural, like it's like a side effect, like.
I don't know.
Become that person, and then you know that. I don't know either. I'm that's a genuine question. I would love to know if there has been any kind of study into that.
I know this. One, hypnotic regression is really loaded with a lot of problems, because the suggestion, even the unintentional suggestions of the hypnotist, so often generate a false memory.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's become a big problem. And it's why, like, Bud Hopkins used that a lot with UFO abductees. And then it was kind of exposed that, no, really, if the hypnotist even faintly, unintentionally suggests that something might have happened, your brain will create a whole story of what happened.
Yeah, 100%.
And,
yeah.
Yeah. And so it's got a lot of problems. But there was one study, and I can't cite it, but I did see something about it quite a couple decades ago, where they were hypnotizing predominantly white people in California and taking them back to their past lives. And a significant number were Chinese railway workers
in
California.
Okay.
Yeah, like a century earlier when the railroads were being built. And there was no direct contact between the Chinese laborers who built the railroads and the people who would be living in the suburbs nearby 100 years later, you know. And yet they had detailed memories. And they that seemed to come out of nowhere. And I found that very impressive, you know?
Yeah, that's very cool. Very.
Yeah, it's fascinating. I, my own self, of all my life, probably the most intense experience I've had was a memory that was revealed, sort of came upon me when I was at an air show when I was like 12, and they were doing a World War II reenactment, and they had the actual planes that fought this battle in the Pacific in World War II. And I, as a 12-year-old boy, just started freaking out because it was so unfair that there are two World War II veterans who were there to narrate it. And it was so unfair that they got to be there and narrate it. And I deserved to be there because I was there too. And, and I believe that I died in that battle. And so many things made so much more sense in my life if I accepted the idea that I had lived before and been a man from the South who was somehow involved with planes in the Pacific in World War II and died there.
Do you have any family members who were in World War II?
Yes. They're deceased now.
Right.
But,
yeah.
But I grew up with them, but they didn't tell a lot of like detailed stories at all. They really didn't discuss the war. This was in the pre-PTSD doesn't exist world,
right,
where, yeah, just have a few drinks, you'll be fine. But they did have severe PTSD. I had two great uncles. One was in the Air Corps over Germany, and the other was in the infantry in Japan. And they both went through a lot, but they didn't ever talk about it like in any detail at all. So it's not like I would have really picked it up from them. And they were great uncles, so I didn't see them all that often. It seemed authentic to me, and it always has, that it came from an actual previous life.
Mm-hmm.
And it just made so much else make sense.
Yeah.
I've lately been involved with the Spiritualist Church.
Okay.
And they're, you know...
you were telling me about this last time.
Yes. Well, and I've continued. And it's been very beneficial for me. I can't tell anybody where they ought to go, but I've gotten a lot out of it.
Well, that's and good.
They're the only religious group. And they're not just a religion. They describe themselves as a religion, a philosophy, and a science. And, you know, one can, you know, push back against that, but I don't. I just take it for what it is. And they're the only group I know that accepts that the personality continues after death.
Okay.
And that as soon as they believed in reincarnation as you, not as, you know, part of a drop of water in the ocean, but as yourself, that, you know, when you die, you go on and you, well, they don't like the term die. They say you never die. Your body dies, but you continue on and you go into an afterlife and you can evolve and continue without a body, or you can come back and take a different body.
Wow. Okay. That's a really, really optimistic view. Like, yes. The most optimistic I've ever heard.
That's why, you know, I hadn't been to, other than weddings and funerals, I really, you know, was a pretty non-religious person for about 25 years or so. And yeah, that they had me at that. It's at least worth it to me to go to the services and have a nice experience. And I can accept that philosophy. Yes, I can.
Yeah. Yeah, you know, sometimes I go to the Universalist Church because they have a lot of pagan events and a lot of pagans hang out there. Be in any of their services, like just the whatever the Universalists believe, I'm not quite sure. But it's a really cool meeting place. I enjoy hanging out there for sure.
They're very open. It's tough to say believe because they're non-dogmatic, and I love that, you know. As the spiritualists are also quite non-dogmatic, their idea of God is very much more of a universal intelligence than it is of a, you know, over anthropomorphized, you better do this or...
Hold on 1 second, Vincent.
You know, sure. We'll just pause here for a moment, folks. 1 second. And we're back here, folks. Yes, we're just talking about reincarnation and the importance of personal reincarnation, of the personality of the individual surviving death and going on to another life. And we're just basically kind of agreeing that'd be pretty cool. Does that summarize it?
Yeah, 100%. Yeah.
All right. All right. Well, just to shift gears here. Recently, you've been discussing fairies. You've been discussing the Fae a fair amount. What would you tell us about that?
Well, I have been recently very interested in the Fae and magic and working with them. I have yet to do any kind of work with them, but I've just been gathering a lot of information and resources and things like that. So I was just actually came out today. I was on 6 Degrees of John Keel with.
Oh, excellent.
And we were just talking about the Fae and how one would work with them safely and effectively and things like that. And I had Dan Harms on my show last week to talk about his new book, The Book of Four Occult Philosophers, which is a, I guess, a 17th century grimoire. And there is a couple different fairy rites in there. Fairies show up probably more than people realize in the classical grimoires. And they're definitely a different view of them than how most modern people would think of them. But they do come up, and people were working with them a very long time ago as they are now.
Very interesting. I've always read that it was quite risky to deal with the Fae. But, okay, I mean, compared to what, demons? I mean, entities, everything's kind of, you know, watch your back type of thing.
When you get into anything spirit, there is an inherent danger because they are not humans. We cannot ascribe human tendencies to them. We don't know really what they are or what they're about. I mean, we have some idea, we have some information here and there from different traditions and things like that, but you always have to keep eyes in the back of your head when you're dealing with things that, you know, don't have bodies.
And I guess that begs the question. Do they have bodies? Are they spirits or are they little people walking around?
I definitely think that they're spirits, and that's the classical view of them. I'm sure that they can take physical form when they want to, especially if you are apt to see them. But I think natively they don't. Hold on 1 second, Vincent.
Sure.
And I'm just gonna. Yeah, no problem.
Yeah, so no, it's no big deal. One of my favorite, and I cannot even recall who was the guest and whose podcast it was, but some guy's dog was just barking in the background the whole time. And meh, what it is. It was still good information and good discussion, and I just wanted to hear it. So yeah, yeah, no problems. But you were saying it was pretty clear that traditionally fairies were thought of as being spirits, not being actual gnomes and pixies and things that are small humanoids that have a physical form.
And to be quite clear, I think all of those things exist. I just think that they're all spirit based. I think that their native is spirit.
And they produce or present a physical appearance as they care to.
Yes.
Okay. Yeah, that makes a lot of sense to me. because I could believe very much that, well, you did an episode recently where your guest had seen a gnome.
Yes.
And I, at the risk of asking you to repeat something that you already, you know, did, for our listeners, could you just tell us about that?
Yeah, so he was living in Seattle, and he was with a friend, and he was walking down the street in downtown Seattle, or maybe a suburb of Seattle, and he saw a little man with a beard and a pointed hat on the street or on the sidewalk. It looked at him and then quickly waddled to across the street and went into, like, there was a flap in the concrete or something like that, and it lifted up the flap and ran down, and when he went, when he chased after this gnome, he saw that he had run down some tiny little stairs. That's the last thing he heard from it or saw of it.
And wasn't there like a post hole?
Yeah.
And
that's what, yeah,
like,
that's what I'm talking
almost
about.
Like a spiral staircase down a, yes, post hole or something.
Yeah, that's what it was.
And then when they went back to look for it, they could not find any of it. Like nothing, mm-hmm, was there.
Yeah.
I found that fascinating. And it made me think of so many of these paranormal entities somehow being real and physical at the moment, but not all the time.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I find it hard to believe that there's really like a network of underground gnome tunnels in Seattle. I have a tough time buying that one. Okay.
Yeah, I do too.
But it can manifest physically for 10 minutes, let's say.
Yes.
Know? And that to me is how I view Bigfoot. And Dogman and things like that, that at the moment they're interacting with somebody, they're completely physical. They break, you know, limbs off trees or whatever, but there's no pen where they go back to. There's no, you know, cave they live in, because otherwise we would have found stuff like that.
Yeah, and I don't give much credit to the nests that people are supposedly finding. I'm not really convinced of that.
Nor am I. I don't say that there aren't tree works and earthworks that are maybe made by them, but I don't think they live in them, because I don't think they occupy physical space other than on rare occasions.
Mm-hmm.
That would be my impression. Now, can they bend something and tie it around? I guess. At the same time, nobody's ever seen them do that. I won't say nobody, because somebody somewhere I'm sure has.
I have yet to hear anyone say that they, with their own eyes, have seen a Bigfoot making tree structures.
And thank you. In his book, well, their book, Joshua Cutchin and Timothy Renner, their excellent pair of books, Where the Footprints End, that they brought that point up, that everybody accredits these knotted, you know, trees and these dugout places that look like something Bigfoot would do, but, mm-hmm, nobody ever sees Bigfoot doing it.
No, never.
They just kind of guess that, well, this is a Bigfoot area, and this thing is like made into a kind of a wigwam type thing. It must be Bigfoot.
And it's weird, because you would think that, like, there's plenty of opportunity to lie about it. Someone could very easily say, like, I saw him make that, or I saw it make that, but no one ever has. I have never heard that. I mean, if someone has, maybe there is, but I have never heard anyone say that they themselves saw it. And that, I don't know, that gives a lot of credence to something else doing it, or it being a completely separate phenomenon that just gets associated with Bigfoot.
Exactly. For the sheer number of encounters with Bigfoot, you think, which people have seen many, many high strangeness things.
Yeah, of course. And, you know, like, since we've never seen a Bigfoot make one, why are we only saying it could be Bigfoot? What about Dogman? What about Goatman? What about Jersey Devil? Like, there are plenty of cryptids that have hands that could be responsible for this, but we never pin that to those.
Yes. It never really gets, it's suggested as Bigfoot. But yeah, there's no real linkage there, and it may be completely unrelated. And for some reason, that's making me think of that Mark Wahlberg movie directed by M. Night Shyamalan, The Happening.
Oh, yeah.
The trees are moving. You know, maybe they just do it themselves. You know, no Bigfoot required. But yes, we start off talking about Fae there. And one thing that is often associated is a connection between fairies, and aliens. What would your thoughts be on that?
I don't know a lot about it because I'm not very well versed in the UFO topic at all or alien topic at all. I definitely agree with the similarities of a fae encounter and an alien abduction being, you know, almost identical, just given their details. The only difference being the sort of society, like the time difference, like one is in Middle Ages and the other is now. But I think it's definitely plausible. I think the idea of the Fae being the dead is very plausible.
As do I, yes. And they seem to have this, you're right, it's a lot about time. The fairies are always the past and the aliens are always the future.
Yes.
And I can't source this quote, but it's a very good quote, and I'm sure a lot of listeners already know who said it, but it's said that the fairies are always going, but never gone, and the aliens are always coming, but never here.
Yes.
And that seems like perhaps the same phenomena, I won't say toying with us, because that makes it sound so trivial, but manipulating us for their own purposes, or purposes we can't comprehend, but probably being the same thing. I wonder, and in the future, just, and there's no right or wrong answer to this, but in the future, do you plan on using magical techniques to summon UFOs?
Yeah, I would definitely like to. I know that the CE5 is kind of already there, but I would definitely like to try my hand and see what can be applied to that phenomena.
Is CE5 a grimoire? Or
no, the CE5 method is John Greer, the physicist or brain surgeon who, like...
Oh, Greer,
yeah. That's his whole, like, if you hit on it, then a UFO will come. You know, it's interesting because I actually have to credit him and that method for getting me into a lot of things, because I remember a documentary of his that came out in, I guess, 2021. And I wanted to try and see if it was real. And so I got into meditation. And from there, I got into a whole bunch of other stuff. And so that, simultaneously with my occult things, was very, really got the ball rolling for me. I don't know if it works. I've actually never tried it.
Okay. Hey, there's nothing wrong with that. That's one thing I've loved about your podcast, that you don't come in as this guru or, you know, 37th degree wizard who knows everything. You're a guy exploring this stuff, as are many of us.
Mm-hmm.
And we're kind of learning as we go along.
Right. Absolutely. Like, when you brought me on as a ceremonial magician, I was saying in my head, like, ceremonial magician in training.
Absolutely.
Before, so it's unfair of me to say that I'm like this big magician. I'm not. I'm really not.
Oh, no. And anybody who listens to your podcast, and I strongly suggest that if you listen to this, you should definitely listen to his. Strange Dominions, Octavian Graves, and Ian are putting out a fascinating podcast. And you should go there, you should become a patron, you should get full access, and it'll totally be worth the price of a Happy Meal.
Thank you very much. I really appreciate that.
Oh, and I mean it, because I'm doing it, you know? And yes, I that bonus content is awesome, but your regular content is awesome. And you guys are just kind of exploring this thing, these many things. And, you know, there's no, I will tell you the truth now because it's been revealed to me decades ago. No, there's none of that. It's just, hey, we're looking at some stuff and this is what we're finding.
Mm-hmm.
And I love that. I love that whole DIY approach. And, you know, it's encouraged me to do some stuff that I would never have done a few years ago.
Okay.
And that's really cool. You know,
I'm really glad that it has had an impact at all. Really?
Oh no, it's having more impact than you think. And you kind of came along at the same time as the Newkirks did with Hellier, and as some other people have done with, no, just go out and find out. Go and, you know, take that step. You know, we as a society, and that's why I brought up Satanism early on and kind of, you know, had several questions in a row about that, because we've been so programmed that in American society, and I'm sure a lot of the rest of the world, but especially in American society, we've been really programmed that if you do anything mystical, magical, occultic, anything at all, it's straight to the devil. Okay. And it's straight to the devil, and he wants your soul. And, you know, Devil Went Down to Georgia was a documentary type of thing. It's been all about the devil. And when you get into this stuff, it's really nothing's about the devil.
No, it's like not really.
5%. It is nothing. It is 1%. It is not really what it's about at all. And once you stop worrying that, you know, Al Pacino in Devil's Advocate is going to show up and look for your soul, once you let that go and look at this stuff for what it is, it becomes very interesting.
Oh, yeah. You have a lot more freedom to look at these things from a nuanced point of view.
Yes, yes. And, you know, I grew up in the satanic panic. And so I didn't touch, without even, you know, it just immersed the culture for a while. And it's doing it again. That's great. You know, I thought we were done with that. But no, there's kind of a second satanic panic going on. And a lot of people end up being trapped by fear.
Yes.
And I don't want that to trap me, and I don't want that to trap anybody. That doesn't mean be stupid or reckless, but it does mean don't be, you know, put in a box because of what you've been told by somebody who probably didn't know what they're talking about, that everything's demonic, because it's not. You know,
yeah. And once you even start like actually getting into the research, that fades away very quickly, and you start to find resources that go exactly against that idea in the first place.
Yes. And I don't ever get tired of saying this, but your explanation of how difficult it is to summon a goetic demon really put my mind at rest about everything being demons, because if you actually want to get a demon, good luck, because it's going to take you 29 hoops to jump through.
Yeah, and even if you do get one here, it's going to be kicking and screaming to get out of here as fast as possible anyway. So, you know, and I will never stop saying it, this idea that there's just a demon lurking around every corner, it's so contrary to everything.
Yes, yes, that's well said. Let me see, where are we here in my little chart? Let's see. I meant to ask you, you come from ethnically a Jewish background. Do you have any interest or experience with Kabbalah?
No, I know nothing about it. I have very little interest in it. The fact, you know, I've become very annoyed because I will ask people, okay, what is Kabbalah and what do you do with it? And no one can answer that question. And it completely turns me off to it. If it doesn't have a utility, I don't want it.
Then exactly. What are we doing here?
Like, I love philosophy, but at least philosophy, you can take a philosophical concept and apply it to your daily life and figure out how it makes use. I can't find anything in Kabbalah that makes my life better or easier or, you know, anything.
No,
like that.
I get you. I don't claim to know much of anything about it. I just, you know, asked and answered. There we are. Question asked, question answered. No problems. I'm obviously not asking for legal confessions here, but to the extent you feel comfortable talking about it, do you have any experiences with psychedelics? And has this affected your magical practices or general worldview?
Yes. And I like to say that basically I don't want to say that I wouldn't be here without mushrooms, but they played a very big part in my development a few years ago. And they really allowed me to like get into this fully and not feel any kind of shame or embarrassment by doing so. They taught me a lot of lessons, ones that I'm still figuring out. But yeah, like, and I don't want to say like I, you know, advocate for them, but they've done a lot of good for me.
Wow. And again, I'm not trying to interrogate you, but that's absolutely fascinating to me. And I've never been particularly shy about revealing this. I am a disabled veteran, and I have severe PTSD. And in that community, mushrooms have become very popular very quickly and are sometimes mentioned as an actual cure for PTSD.
Mm-hmm.
Now, they advise you to only do it basically holding your psychologist's hand while you do it in a controlled setting, which that's the only way to do it, okay, to be honest. Because I don't want to see everything I could possibly see. But I agree that there are very probably a great deal of benefit to be found there. Would you like go elaborate a little bit on what they've done for you?
So I have also heard that they cure PTSD and cure depression. And I think that that doesn't get elaborated on enough in the sense that people think that they can just take a high dose and their mental illness will be cured if they're doing it with their...
Oh, no.
Go ahead. And it's not like that. Like, if you really want it to have the true medicinal purposes and you're doing it for that reason, then you should be doing it with someone who knows how to administer it in that way. I had what I would call like four really fun, happy, awesome experiences and then two really, really bad ones. The first bad one was kind of like a harsh religious experience. Like I got a lot out of it. And
if I may interrupt you for a second, that fascinates me because you didn't grow up religious, correct?
No.
Okay. Please carry on.
Religious in the sense that it just opened my mind up to a whole new world of possibilities. I'm still staunchly against the big three, or really organized religion at all. I guess maybe a spiritual experience is better to a better way of putting that. But there was a return on that investment, if that makes sense. The second bad trip was just a very bad business deal through and through. I got burned 100%. No real payoff, no return, though, no big download, like mental download or anything like that. But the first one, I mean, it sent me back mentally. And I think it like gave me mental illness, honestly. Like, I was a very happy-go-lucky person before that, and I think it like woke me up. I also did it at like a very pivotal time in my life. I was 25, and your brain becomes fully aware at 25, and it was a very extreme way of ushering in adulthood, honestly. Oh. And cognitive adulthood, if that makes sense.
Yes, no, it does make a lot of sense.
And it gave me, you know, you deal with a lot already just turning 25, and like, you know, when your brain becomes fully developed, you start to realize a lot of things. You add mushrooms to that and the things that it shows you, and you have a lot to work through and a lot to contemplate on, and things that I'm still working through and chewing on and have, you know, problems with and things like that. But overall, I would say it was a very, very important experience and one that I think I needed. And it's shaped me in a lot of ways. So, I mean, that's the best way I can really talk about it.
No, that makes a lot of sense. I think I get you. And again, no interrogation here going on, but So we've only been talking about psilocybin. Any DMT or LSD or other experiences? You don't have to answer that.
I've never done LSD, and honestly, I don't think I ever will, just because, like, everything about it scares me. Like, there's not a single silver lining in it for me. Just the way that I've heard about it and seen things and things like that. I've done DMT twice in my life, but I've never actually gotten to break through. And marijuana,
machine elves?
No, nothing like that.
You know what I'm talking about, though.
Yeah. The self-transforming of machine elves.
Terrence McKenna's thing, yeah.
Yeah, I got to the door both times. Basically, my body like rejected it and freaked out. And marijuana just makes me have a terrible panic attack. Like, even like the worst I've ever been on mushrooms would have been a field day on weed for me. Like, weed just is just so debilitating to me. I don't know why it's been like that my entire life.
No, I actually concur. Now, this is not a political statement. I believe it should be legal. That's fine.
Yeah, same.
I just have no interest in it. Because my experiences have been at best, well, that was pleasant. But they've, at worst, I did the edibles.
Oh, my God.
And the edibles, nothing was happening, so I took more edibles. And I took a little too many edibles. And I had the attention span of a gnat. Okay, I couldn't remember what the hell I was doing. I got lost in my own house. It was a drag. It was nothing I ever wanted to have happen again. My anxiety went up. I was told, like, it was supposed to chill me out. It did not do that.
No, it doesn't do that for me either, trust me.
I had to consciously talk myself down. Like, you're okay. This is going to wear off. Just be cool and go to bed. Okay.
Yeah.
Because it was messed up. And I remember like trying to make coffee and it taking like an hour because I couldn't figure out what the hell was going on. I kept losing my train of thought. But the worst part, the reason I don't care for marijuana at all either, is I have I ramble a lot. Spoiler alert, folks. I tend to sometimes babble. I like to talk a lot. I'm always like that. Alcohol opens that up so even more. Marijuana shuts it down. It's like my internal monologue gets turned so far down that like I'm slowed down and I can only think in like one word per second. I hate that. Oh, no thanks, man.
Yeah, I'm not a fan of that either, trust me.
Yeah, I mean, if you experience the same kind of thing in like slowed down thinking.
No, it's just, I'm going to die. I'm going to die. These are my last
minutes. Wow.
I'm going to die. I crumple up into a ball. I can't move. My skin is crawling. My brain just like, I can't remember what I just did. Like, time isn't working right. You know, like, it's just.
Oh, I hated that.
Yeah.
The time distortion is terrible. I really don't mess with that stuff because it just, the image that's promoted of the happy-go-lucky, you know, relaxed stoner. I'm not saying there's nobody like that. There's probably a bunch of people like that.
Mm-hmm.
But that's not everybody.
No.
And, you know, there's a lot of, you know, kind of iffy marketing on marijuana, to be very honest. I know CeeLo Green, the musician, stopped doing marijuana because it was giving him panic attacks. And I can totally relate to that. Yeah. As you said, yeah. Let's see. Honestly, Octavian, we've kind of had a very good conversation here.
100%. I really had a lot of fun talking to you.
Yes, same here. I got just a couple of things before we wrap things up.
Sure.
And this is just kind of a potpourri of, you know, what you might have to say. And nothing is a totally fine answer. Do you have any thoughts on these things being shot down recently?
You know, I haven't really looked that much into it. I've been planning on trying to find out information on it, but it's, you know, it's so hard to get into it now because it's just going to be a disinformation campaign for the next like 6 months on it, you know?
Oh, yes. I don't believe that there are any actual aliens involved, but I think there's a lot of governments playing a shell game with us.
Yes.
For reasons absolutely. We have no idea, you know? I don't feel it's the beginning of Independence Day. I really don't.
No, I don't either.
I don't think that's, honestly, I don't think it's ever going to happen. But, yeah. Let's see. I had one other thing that I wanted to ask you, and that was about any thoughts that you have, and again, nothing is a perfectly acceptable answer, any thoughts you had about pre-existing civilizations, lost civilizations?
Are we talking like Graham Hancock type stuff? Because I'm very into that.
Oh, yes, absolutely. I binge watched Ancient Apocalypse.
Yeah, that was a great show. And I love all his theories. I don't know if they're right, but I find them very, very interesting and compelling for sure.
Absolutely.
And I definitely believe in like Atlantis. I
totally do myself.
Yeah.
I don't have a set amount of details on how that worked. Yeah. But I think that happened.
Yeah.
That we are not the highest level that we've
ever reached. No, we are not. This has all happened before.
Again and again, yes. How does that work, would you say, with magic? That, you know, how is this continued over time? The spirits teach it to us, as you've explained, but they also kind of preserve it, or people preserve it, or does it go back as far as humans have been human?
Are you saying like the magic is preserved?
Yes. Is it, or does it have to be recreated again and again and again?
I would imagine that there are spirits who have information on the kind of magic that these earlier precursor civilizations were doing and had access to. You know, just taking Atlantis as an example, the Egyptians said, I could be totally butchering this. I think I am, but I'm just going to say it anyway. I'm pretty sure that the Egyptians felt that their magic had come from the Atlanteans, and then the Greeks got it from the Egyptians. And then you also have the Akkadians, the Syrian, you know, the Assyrians and the Babylonians. They aren't a lost civilization. We know a lot. We don't know a lot about them, but we know enough. But I definitely think that you could probably, there's a spirit out there who knows how stuff was done way back then and could probably teach it to you. And they could probably tell you information about what really went down with Atlantis, things like that.
And would it be fair to say that they sometimes seek people out to tell them this stuff? Because they need, for some reason, they need to communicate with us. Does it sound
wrong? I would like to believe that. The only reason I have any hesitation is I've been trying like hell to contact spirits and I haven't gotten any luck with that. But I'm sure it happens. I'm sure that they go out and look for certain people. I don't know what the qualifications are to be chosen by spirits. And I think that's been diluted a lot by the New Age movement in a lot of ways. But I think it does happen at some point.
And what you've just said is why I have such a problem with people who see H.P. Lovecraft as this unknowing, accidental medium prophet source. And it's like there's people who are spending extraordinary effort to try to contact the other and maybe sometimes getting somewhere. And here's a guy who says, I don't believe in any of that. I was just writing fiction.
Right.
I'm an atheist. Yeah. I don't believe in any of that crap. I was fiction. I write some fiction. Leave me alone. You know? And no, he wasn't writing fiction. He thought he was writing fiction, but really he was being channeling the old ones. It's like, well, there's like a bunch of people who want to channel the old ones, and the old ones aren't giving them the time of day. That doesn't always make sense to me.
Right. Yeah.
I keep Kenneth Grant and that whole idea on one side of the scale. Like, that I don't dismiss it. At first, I dismissed it completely. The only thing that convinced me was a timeline of when Lovecraft wrote certain things and when Crowley wrote certain things, and they didn't really have any contact. And that was pretty impressive. At the same time, I keep it in mind that maybe he was just writing fiction. You know?
Yeah.
I find that completely believable. Yes. Okay, this is kind of from left field, and we are wrapping things up here. But have you ever heard of Ashtar Command?
I've heard of it. I know nothing about it.
Okay. It was a group of, for lack of, UFO contactees who were getting messages from an entity calling itself Ashtar. Mm-hmm. And if that doesn't sound almost exactly like Ashtoreth, you know, that can't be a coincidence.
No.
And I just wondered, would it make sense that the, correct me if I'm wrong, Ashtoreth is a major Goetic four-star general type demon, right?
Yes, Ashtoreth is a big name in the grimoires and grimoire world. There is a lot of speculation on the idea of Goetic spirits being gods that were just demonized. I know that there's a lot of evidence against that, that's saying that these spirits have always just been spirits. I tend to go on that side. I'm not saying it's impossible that some of these are gods, but I would put more stock in them not being gods.
And obviously the term gods, small g, is quite flexible, you know. And a spirit could be worshipped by people and considered a god. And, you know, there's some leeway there, would you say?
Yes, 100%.
Yes. It just, it seems strange that such a similar name would then come back contacting people, and usually contacted them during meditation or contacting them psychically and purporting to be a space, a leader of a space fleet from another planet. That just seems like there's a interconnection there that can't be ignored. And don't worry, I don't have all the answers. I have no idea what that means exactly, but I found it very interesting.
Oh, it's very interesting. The whole topic is very, very interesting.
And just to drop one more, and I have to tell my audience that I am totally hitting Octavian with questions I have not prepared in advance for.
Yeah, no, it's okay.
So, you know, if it's, you know, take it for what it's worth. I'm just kind of bombarding him right now, but which I appreciate you for playing along with that. Because no, those answers have been very interesting. Are you at all familiar with the seance that interacted with the Nine back in the 50s?
No, the only reference I have for that, it was an episode that Soraya did on Where Did the Road Go? But other than that, I have nothing about the Nine.
Okay. And just for the listeners, in the 50s, a group of very important people, like Washington, D.C. Blue Bloods, came together and did a seance and said they were contacted by the Nine, who said they were nine principles, and said that they were also ancient Egyptian deities. And this has continued to be a thing ongoing for decades. And Puharich, his, now I'm blanking on his name. Puharich was a government scientist. He was involved with this. Uri Geller was involved with this. It goes a lot of places, and it's very interesting and worth looking up. But it's not easily explained in any short form, and I don't have any great answers on it. I think that'll be the last of my left field pitches. But hey, thanks a ton for being here, Octavian. I really appreciate
it. It's my pleasure. I love being on, and I'm definitely going to have you on very, very soon on Strange Dominions.
That sounds great. I am totally available.
Awesome.
Well, folks, thanks for listening. This has been The Weird Part. I am your host, Vincent Truewell. My guest has been Octavian Graves, host of Strange Dominions, which you should definitely listen to. Thank you and good night.
All right, how was that?